Salam, and welcome to the Logic of the Birds podcast. With me today to discuss the poetry of Al-Hallaj are Professor Carl Ernst, Emeritus Professor at the University of North Carolina, and Professor Cyrus Sargar, Professor at the University of Central Florida. Professor Ernst, could you please tell us a bit about your relationship to this poet? What attracted you to Al-Hallaj's poetry? You know, you have a wonderful book of translations of Hallaj's poetry out now. How did you get interested in Al-Hallaj and his poetry?
Well, years ago when I was a graduate student at Harvard, I was studying with Anna Marie Schimmel. And it was unforgettable in her classes, the extraordinary reach she had in Arabic, Persian, and many other languages. And there was one year in which we spent a lot of time on Hallaj. And she had written out the poems in her own handwriting, what people refer to as a European hand, which was very clear and distinctive. And those poems really made an impact on me. They stuck with me because of the tremendous intellectual power as well as emotion that is contained in them. And I discussed a number of those poems in my dissertation, which was published as a book called Words of Ecstasy and Sufism. And years later, actually, I found that I still was thinking about these poems. And I realized that nobody had attempted to translate the majority of them into English. And so I decided to take that on. And so I ran a graduate seminar with five very intrepid PhD students. And I decided to publish the results. And so it is also, I should say, it's important to point out, it's the largest body of early Arabic poetry by a Sufi. And yet, it is also problematic because, after all, we're talking about someone who was executed for heresy and whose books were burned. So the task of identifying what is authentic in these poems is not simple. And then there's a third point, which is that the legacy of Hallaj was made available to modern readers largely through the influence of the French Orientalist Louis Massignon, who had a very complicated relationship with Hallaj, and that has to be untangled. So all those things pulled me into the project, and I really enjoyed it.
No, I really enjoyed the fruits of it as well, too. Thank you very much. Professor Zaga, what about you? What kind of attracted you to Al-Hallaj's poetry? What have you come to appreciate about it?
Well, I've always been drawn to artists for whom the art and the artist are kind of one. In other words, you can't really separate, in this case, the poetry from the life of Hallaj. And it comes through in the poems. And so it gives his poetry this this depth and complexity and sense of being alive and very fresh. I mean, Dr. Ernst was talking about how early it is. And yet if you read it and compare it to, I mean, a lot of other early Sufi poetry, it has this sense of almost being composed extemporaneously, and it has this vividness to it. And you can't take Hallaj out of the poems, the persona Hallaj, you know. As much of it is legendary or real, it doesn't really matter, you know. So, yeah, when I first encountered Hallaj's poems, again, I was a graduate student. I was alone in a library. And the words just came off the page and had this shocking quality, as I think they're supposed to. It might seem kind of like an odd comparison. I think the natural comparison to me in Persian poetry is Hafez, because Hafez has that, he somehow makes it seem so personal and vivid, though the biography part, you know, maybe less so. But I know in the case of Iraqi, for example, you know, there's a biographical element too. But in a contemporary sense, the person I think of most often when I think of Hallaj, it might sound funny, is Prince. Because, throughout Prince's career, who he was always a part of his music. And he had these personas that would be a part of the music. And, his name mattered in a way that it didn't for other artists. And controversy, you know, pushing the envelope, so to speak, pushing matter. So I was very drawn to him in his poetry. It was an immediate connection for me.
Yeah, I know what you mean. There's a real strong sense of urgency in the poems that just comes through. Like, as you said, they kind of leap off the page right at you. Professor Ernst, you mentioned that Hallaj was executed for heresy. Can you give us a bit more context or a little introduction to his context and life. Where did he live? What led to his execution? Who were his teachers?
Well, we have lots of stories about him, and they're not all consistent with each other, which is not surprising given the circumstances. But he was born in Western Persia, or Eastern Iraq, I guess you might say, Ahvaz, and of family that was originally from Iran, but he grew up speaking only Arabic. And he was a student of some of the most prominent Sufis of Baghdad in the early days, people like Sahle Tostari, like Amr Mekki, and of course Junaid, the great master of Baghdadian Sufism. But he seems to have been tagged as a troublemaker early on. And we are told, for instance, that at one point he picked up a writing of Amr Mekki and kept it when he was not given permission to do so. Another story, a version of that, he is said to have been walking with Amr Mekki, and the latter was reciting the Quran, and Halaj at one point said, "I can write something like that," which was a bit shocking. And his master apparently said to him, according to that story, "Your blood will stain the gallows." So there was a sense in which he was in conflict with the Sufi tradition from the beginning. And later on, he traveled extensively. He dressed as a soldier. He did not act in conformity with the pattern that was emerging under this group of like-minded mystics who were emerging in the early Abbasid Caliphate. He eventually fell afoul of the politics of the day. I think there's no other way to explain it. There was a tremendous conflict going on. The caliphate was kind of teetering. There were rebellious governors. There were sectarian groups. There was a big rebellion of the African enslaved people in the Iraqi marshes. There was the Ismailis were trying to stage a revolt against the Sunni caliphate. And one little telltale evidence of that is when the Karamita, a group of Ismailis, attacked Mecca and destroyed the Kaaba because they thought it was an idolatrous pilgrimage practice. And then they eventually had to realize that it was going to happen anyway, so they accepted a huge ransom for the Black Stone, and it was rebuilt. So there was financial manipulation going on in the grain market and all kinds of problems. And so Halaj spent about 9 years in jail with trials going off and on, and he was visited during that time by some of his admirers, such as the great Sufi of Shiraz, Ibn al-Khafif. And eventually, he was executed. And this execution has been dramatized in such a theatrical manner that it's unforgettable. Attar, the great Persian poet, tells the story in his biographical work on the Sufis, which culminates in the story of Halaj. And of course, Halaj is famous for having said, "I am the truth," a statement which was interpreted in many different ways, but it was clearly scandalous. And Attar depicts him marching to his execution, and he says they cut off his hands and feet, and he continued to say, "I am the truth." They cut off his head, and his head continued to say, "I am the truth." They burned his body to ashes, and the ashes cried, "I am the truth." So we couldn't shut this guy up. And so his followers were persecuted, and there was a time when you couldn't even mention his name. And people, even writing in faraway Bukhara, such as Golabadi in his Kitab al-Ta'aruf, he only refers to Halaj by saying "one of the great ones." He won't say his name. And so there were at least almost 50 of his writings that were mentioned by the great bibliographer al-Nadim, of which hardly any trace remains. And so one of the characteristic anecdotes which is indicative of his status is a story that's told by Poshehri, the great formulator of Sufism in Khorasan in the early 11th century. His teacher ordered Poshehri to go to the library of the great Sulami and steal a book, which was the Poems and Prayers of Halaj. And so you can see how, at the same time, how respected and admired, but at the same time, how shockingly controversial he was. So this is the kind of image that we have.
Wow, that's amazing. It sounds like he lived an incredibly wild time, and even in that time was something of a wild figure in that time too. Professor Zargar, do you have anything to add to that too?
Well, I do. Just I mean, for me, the historical halaj is incredibly interesting, you know, and what's come out of research, you know, on that from Dr. Ernst and, of course, Louis Messignon before. It's incredibly important. But for me, with the writings of Halaj, there, again, that element of his legendary biography, how he becomes converted into a symbol himself, right? In the Tazkiratul Awliya, in Fariduddin Attar's text, I mean, that in many of the manuscripts, that's the last story. It's got this kind of, as Dr. Ernst said, it has this, it's like the apex, right? It's Attar is a Halajian in his spirituality. And what does that mean? That comes from the biography. That comes from the legend of Halaj, because he comes to represent in his life Sufism's greatest secret, which is that insofar as we are not ourselves, we are God. God is within us. And what I think makes his the legend of Halaj, the symbol of Halaj, so powerful, is that it's an exercise in truth-telling. Because covering up a secret is a kind of a lie. And to reveal the secret is a kind of truth-telling. But because it's a truth-telling that brings you shame, it embarrasses you, and maybe even others, right? It's associated with drunkenness, because that's what the drunk person does. The drunk person reveals things that shouldn't be revealed. And in the process, humiliates himself, right? So he's a drunk Sufi in that sense, right? And Junaid was a sober Sufi in the other sense, in that he doesn't reveal it. And he's a true fata. He's a true young man in that tradition, you know, the wearing the clothes of the soldier. That associates him with fatwa. And he says, he declares himself that there were only three sort of perfect fata outlaws, you know, manifestations of fatwa in the sense of outlaws, which is himself, Pharaoh, and Satan, Iblis. And to make that triumvirate, right, of three hated figures, and to seek, again, I don't know if this is historically accurate, I'd like to hear Dr. Ernst on that, but to seek out the hatred of people and to get it. You know, I mean, you can look in books that are not even in the Sufi tradition, where Halaj is mentioned with the phrase La'anahullah after him, right? So it's like God's curse be upon him. It's now, according to the legend, he wanted that. And he sought that because it was a way of purifying his love. Being hated by humans meant that his love for God was pure. One perspective mattered to him. Only one entity mattered to him, and it was God's. So the life and history of Halaj is an incredibly important part of his writings. Like, for example, if you think about the Shatriyat, you think about his statements. They're not poetry, but what are they? They're statements that cut through normative discourse. They cut through it the way poetry does, right? Verse might do that in metered speech and being ornate and all this, but the Shatriyat does it in its shock value. For me, Halaj is all those things.
Thank you. So as you mentioned, Halaj didn't just write poetry. We also still have his kind of mysterious Kitab al-Tawasin, where I think he gives his famous defense of Iblis. And I once heard somebody say, the person who said an al-haq in public, the things he puts in mysterious symbols in Tawasin, you should pay attention to. So the person who's not afraid to go out and say, I am the truth, I am God in public, when he starts speaking in symbols and riddles, you should pay attention. Could you give us a little sense of, before we move on to his poetry, this kind of literary context, the other works that he was writing, or the kind of state of Sufi discourse at the time of when Halaj was writing?
Well, the fragments that we have include a number of Quranic comments, which were collected by authors like Sulami and Khosheiri and others, and Ruzbahan. And so those are little pieces, little fragments on comment of a particular verse of the Quran. There is also a peculiar collection of sayings that are hadith-like, which are transmissions from, not from human beings, but from cosmic entities. This is called the riwayat, and it is very striking indeed. And then the book that you mentioned, the Tawasin, is an enigmatic collection of short pieces, which is richly expressed, and which includes some of his poems. and it contains the dialogues with Moses and Iblis, who are two liminal characters in the Islamic cosmos. And there is a profound reverence for the Prophet Muhammad expressed in this as well. So his piety is so intense. He is said to have been asked about what was his school of theology, what madhab did he belong to? And he said, from every madhab, I take that which is most difficult, and I practice that. So the intensity is so remarkable, it comes through. And then the other source that we have for him are the narratives about him, which is called Akhbar al-Hallaj, the stories of Hallaj. And this is a collection of stories which is dramatic in a way that I have rarely seen in other documents from this period. Because you have a narrator who is one of his close friends or disciples, and they relate intimate things like seeing him praying at night in the mosque or the graveyard, and speaking to the people and saying to them in a tone of someone who is going out of his mind that there is no duty that is more important for Muslims than to kill me, because I must be erased so that God alone will be there. So the poems did not exist independently as a kind of collected works in a literary sense, but they were always spliced into these prayers and narratives. And that collection we know was circulating in a number of places as far as India. And so that's basically what we have. The other documents that are referred to that were destroyed have very intriguing titles, and it's clear that he was writing some works for the political elite of Baghdad, some of whom were his supporters. And so he had a political profile. And then there were cosmic titles that still are fascinating. We can't imagine exactly what is in there. But you mentioned illusion, symbol, ciphers, codes. And the notion of telling the secret, this was the great tension in his life. He was impelled to blurt out in public what the Sufis wanted to keep in an esoteric private circle. So the notion of his writings was extremely important because that's how he was partly transmitting his teachings to the public. And the longer biographies of him that are found in works like The History of Baghdad, the great collection of biographies of scholars, is just amazing. I mean, you can't really make up the kinds of things that he was doing. So the literary presence is very strong, and even despite his fragmentary character.
No, that's fascinating. I forget the source I saw this in. Someone said that he had set up a model Kaaba in his backyard and had people, he and other people would go circumambulate it as well too, which, and in the context, you know, in which the Ismailis, the Karamathia, had just destroyed the Kaaba, or, you know, unbelievable.
That's actually the technicality on which they finally decided to execute him. Because I Am the Truth did not come up in the trial, as far as we can tell. But the prosecutor in his trial brought up this text from one of his writings, which said that if you didn't have enough money to go to Mecca on Hajj, you could build a little Kaaba in your backyard or in your living room, and then invite some orphans and feed and clothe them, and then circumambulate that, and that would count. And you're right, it was too inappropriately timed because of the attack on Mecca by the Karamita. And so at that point, when one of the judges heard this document quoted that he was trying to have a substitute pilgrimage, he says, your blood is legal right now. And so there's a dramatic portrait of this in one of the historical chronicles. And they basically ran it through the court in a kind of illegal way, and it was over.
Wow. But as Professor Zargar said, in a certain sense, he seemed to kind of want it. I mean, he kept saying to people, and at least in some of these sources, and in his poetry as well, too, you have all of these, uqtuluni ya thiqati, kill me, my friends. It's very, very mysterious. Okay, well, speaking of the poetry now, let's turn to that. Professor Zargar, could you give us some examples of some of your favorite poems or some of the poems of Hallaj that are the most celebrated? And tell us why you think they're so celebrated, why they've continued to resonate down through the ages.
Sure, I'll give one because it's a bit longer, so I can read the whole thing. So I'll just read maybe a few lines of the Arabic, and then I'll read the translation. لبيك لبيك يا سري ونجوائي لبيك لبيك يا قصدي ومعنائي أدعوك بل أنت تدعوني إليك فهل نديت إياك أم نديت إيائي يا عين عيني وجودي يا مدى هممي يا منطقي وعباراتي وإمائي يا كل كلي يا سمعي ويا بصري يا جملتي وتباعيضي وأجزائي يا كل كلي وكل الكل ملتبس والكل كلك ملبوس بمعنائي. So this is a translation. Labaik, labaik. So labaik is what the pilgrims say, of course, on the Hajj pilgrimage. I am at your service. Here I am at your service, O Lord. Labaik, labaik, O my secret and my secret conversation. Labaik, labaik, O my intention and my meaning. I called on you. No, you called me to you. So did I cry out to you, or did you cry out to me? O source of the source of my being, O utmost of my endeavors, O my speech, my expressions, and my gestures, O all of me, and O my hearing, and O my sight, O my whole and my divisions and the parts that make me up. O all of me, and all of the all is perplexing, and all of you is worn garb-like in my meaning. O you to whom my spirit was bound and became destroyed in ecstasy, such that I am hostage to my desires. I weep out of grief for my disunion from my homeland, undertaken voluntarily. Even my enemies are wailing in sympathy with me. I draw near, but my fear banishes me, and a yearning that has settled in the hidden depths of my stomach disturbs me. So what should I do in a vast expanse to which I've been consigned? My master, the doctors have grown weary of my sickness. They say, cure him of it. I say to them, people, will you treat this disease with a disease? My love for my master weakens me and makes me sick. So how can I complain to my master? My master, truly I look at him, and the heart knows him. So what can interpret him other than my gesticulations? Woe unto my spirit, and what a pity for me about me, for I am the source of my own calamity. It is as if I am drowning when his fingertips appear to come to my aid, while he too is in an ocean of water. There is no one who knows what I've endured, except for the one who alighted from me in my heart's innermost blood. That is the one who knows the prolonged illness I've undergone, and in his wish is my death and my revival. O extremity of what is sought and what is hoped for, O my haven, O life of my spirit, and O my religion and my worldliness. So that is a very famous poem of Hallaj's, very well known. But I think for me, it's a great example of why I'm drawn to him as a poet. You can see that there's a repeat, all these explanations, these this and that, right? And it has this lyrical and rawness, a raw aspect to it, right? And this kind of addictive, like rhyme that goes throughout it, the clapping. And of course, in it occurs the verb that's related to hulul that would cause so much controversy that he's accused of. In many of the texts of hulul, incarnation, believing in or promoting the idea that God can be incarnate in a human being, and that incurs in one of the baits. So it has that controversial aspect as well. But you can see that it's completely personal, right? Because it is as if I am drowning when his fingertips appear to come to my aid while he too is in an ocean of water. There is no one who knows what I've endured except for the one who alighted from me in my heart's innermost blood. وَلَيْسَ يَعْلَمُ مَا لَقِيتُ مِنْ أَحَدٍ إِلَّا الَّذِي حَلَّ مِنِّي فِي سُوَيْدَائِ. So you can see that certainly the word comes up, but it's you can see that it's a personal and first person expression of what you would call fana, the annihilation of selfhood. Oh, and lastly, tying into the point about the legend, Dr. Ernst was talking about the importance of the Hajj in the Hallaj controversy, and that comes up right from the beginning. But you see, his Hajj is different. His pilgrimage is in a direction that no one else goes in. He's on his own Hajj, It's a really beautiful poem, and one that to me encapsulates everything I love about Hallaj.
No, that's wonderful. Thank you so much. Professor Ernst, I know you have a whole book of poems and translations to choose from, but could you share with us some of your favorite verses or some of the ones that you think are most appropriately celebrated and famous today?
I think that we would probably want to mention the famous poem that you quoted earlier, "Oqtuluni ya thaqati, inna fi qatli hayati." This poem is extraordinary because of its resonance. The short lines have a strong verbal impact. And it also is absolutely shocking in so far as it is a demand to be executed. And moreover, the poem is complex because I think it can be divided into three different sections, in the first of which there is this appeal to be annihilated. In the second, there is a kind of riddle about the nature of time and its paradoxes. In the third part, there is a kind of alchemical transformation. And so I'll read you my translation of this one. And this is such a famous poem. It's quoted extensively by people like Rumi, for instance, who works it into his own poems frequently. And so we know that this was very memorable. He says, "Kill me, friends, for in my killing is my life. My death is in my life. My life is in my death. Annihilation of my essence is the noblest of my glories, and my attributes remaining is the foulest of my crimes. My spirit tires of my life amidst its lingering traces. So kill me, burn me in these fading bones, and later pass the dust in ruined tombs. You'll find my lover's secret folded into my remains." Part two. "I was a mighty patriarch of lofty rank. Then I became a child in wet nurses' chambers, living in a grave's niche in marshy grounds. My mother bore her father, that's one of my marvels. Then my daughters, after they were daughters, were my sisters. This was no deed of time nor act of adultery." Part three. "So gather all my parts together from burning bodies, from air and fire, and next from water pure, then plant it all in earth whose soil is fallow, and swear to water it from cups passed round by running waitresses with running waters. When you finish seven, the best of plants will bloom." This is an extraordinary poem. And ironically, he talks about the lover's secret remaining buried with him. That didn't happen with Halaj. He let the secret out. But that is a real stunner. And I'd like to add to that another one which is not so well known and which I found to be extraordinarily moving because it talks about the breaking of the secret. And so this one, which begins, "Man sarruhu fa'abda kulla masataru wa lam yura'i itasala kana kashasha." There's a harshness in the rhyme that is pretty striking. It goes like this. "One they confide in, who blurts out all that they concealed and maintains no connection, is nothing but a swindler. If souls reveal the secret of what they have learned and everything their intellect acquired, beware. One who fails to protect the secret of his lord and master, they will not trust with secrets while he lives. They punish him for misdeeds of the past and make him trade society for loneliness. They avoid him, for he's not fit for their company, since they see him as a grave robber of secrets. One whom they tell a secret which he then betrays, that one, like me, is frivolous to these people. They are a people of a secret, created for secrets, and they have no patience for what is obscene. They won't welcome a revealer in their assemblies, and they don't love a veil that's treated lightly. They will not choose a revealer for their secrets. Beware of their majesty, of that beware. So be with them and for them in every misfortune, polite to them as long as you last." This is a harsh statement about his relationship with the Sufis, who shrunk from defending him except for a few. And those who defended him included Ibn Attah, who was beaten to death with his shoes by the police of the caliph. So he didn't have it easy. And these poems, as Dr. Sargar points out, are very personal. And when this comes across in such a powerful way, it's unforgettable.
Wow. Now that's both of them, all three poems, simply stunning. Thank you so much. I mean, we've already started to do this, but could we identify some of these kind of main themes or concepts or motifs that kind of wet across Halaj's poetic oeuvre. I mean, so we have secret keeping, secret telling. We have death, longing for death. We have this intense, intense personal love, physical, really. It's in his blood. It's in his guts. Kind of love for God and the prophet. But there are other themes or motifs that kind of cut across this big selection of poetry that he has.
Well, what comes to mind immediately, it's going to seem a little bit abstract. And I'd like to hear Dr. Ernst comment on this, actually, knowing his knowing some of the work he's done on other types of mysticism. But the tension between dualism and non-dualism, I would actually say that's like the main theme. Because he has this an al-haq, right? I am the real, I am the truth, and this the fana, you know, in the ocean, disappearing. But then he has this kill me aspect, and the kill me aspect is, you know, put into action the law. In other words, the divisions between creation and creator must be observed, and I think that's the tension that runs throughout his Diwan and even his biography, that tension. So to me, that's if I had to get it down to even to one theme, it would be that tension between dualism and non-dualism.
I think that's a very good way to put it. And I like the word tension, because I think, you know, there's a tendency for people to talk about mysticism as if people reach this state and then everything is over. It's all oneness. But Halaj is kind of unstable. And he testifies to agonizing transitions between these different poles of duality and non-duality. And I think one of the things the poems do effectively is to convey the sense of annihilation through demonstration rather than theory. I'll give you one example. This one uses images like the ocean and the desert, which are ostensibly opposite, but he uses them to make the same point. He says, "My glance gestured with the eye of knowledge toward a pure essence with my hidden thought, and a light flashed in my awareness, subtler than the understanding of my fanciful ambition. So I dove into the wave of my thought's ocean, passing through it just like an arrow, and my heart flew with a feathered longing, mounted on the wings of my intention. Toward him for whom, if I'm asked about him, I provide a symbol, but I don't name him. Until when I crossed over every limit, I wept in the deserts of nearness. I looked, and there I was in a book of destiny, but I could not get beyond the limits of my record. So I went on in submission to him, with the rope of my guidance in the hand of resignation. Love has imprinted my heart with him, with the brand of longing, and what an imprint. Awareness of my essence faded away in nearness until I forgot my name."
Wow.
Wow. That's...
yeah. That's moving.
That's pretty incredible. I was thinking as you were reading that too, you know, most deserts were once oceans. And if you dive down to the bottom of the ocean floor, most places is a desert. So I almost have this image of, yeah, I'm diving down to the bottom of the ocean, reaching it, and then walking around all alone in the deserts of nearness. That's spectacular. Thank you so much. We've kind of already started to answer this, but why does Halaj turn to poetry? I mean, he seems to use it very, very effectively to communicate, as you said, the kind of experience to demonstrate what fana, annihilation, is like. But we know he also wrote prose. Well, why did he turn to poetry as a means of expressing his states, his ideas, his feelings? Well, why did he turn to poetry? And what is he doing with poetry that, you know, perhaps you couldn't do with prose or with other things?
Well, I think we have to acknowledge that Abbasid society at this time was permeated with poetry in a profound way. People at all levels of society were engaged with it. It's in the court, it's in the scholarly circles, it's in the street. And among the Sufis, it's striking to see that in the early collections of prose works about Sufi practice, there is generally a chapter on the poetry and also on the correspondence between different Sufis. And there are some stories that are quite telling, which show someone writing a letter to his friend sending it from Khorasan to Baghdad. The recipient opens it up, reads the letter, turns it over, and writes a poem on the back, and it returns it. And so this was something that was very much part of the situation. And it also explains why the Sufis were very appreciative of the court poetry of Abu Nuwas, who is renowned for his libertine proclivities. And yet they just found it so captivating. Hojwiri, who quotes a verse from Abu Nuwas, says, although it's on a frivolous subject, yet this contains a very significant meaning, which he then expounds. So I think that's one of the reasons why. But Hallaj also was clearly gifted in this respect. And a number of the authors who quote him refer to his literary abilities. And I suspect that there was a lot of spontaneous composition, which really means that they were deeply immersed in the poetic genres. And although you might think that poetry requires greater planning and intellectual structure, when people are on this level of immersion into the aesthetic, that all goes to work kind of subconsciously, and the result that comes out is something that probably couldn't have been planned very much in a normal sense. So I don't know. I think that poetry was intimately part of the experience of the Sufis, and this, of course, takes them into the realm of music, which is another subject.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, you can really only freestyle if you know the rules and the forms, and they become part of your flesh and bones, as it were. Professor Zargar, anything to add to that?
Well, just to really echo Dr. Ernst, he put it so beautifully. I mean, you know, by and large, in the history of Sufi literature, Sufism doesn't create forms and genres. It does things to them, right? It does things to the existing forms and genres. So you get to, you know, from tafsir, you get Sufi tafsir. You get tabaqat, then you get the Sufi version of tabaqat. And so too with poetry, and even with the forms and genres within poetry, right? You get, you know, you get madh, you get the, you know, you get the erotic poetry, you get on and on, you get the existing forms and genres. They take on this added level, layer of meaning, and they're really part of this communal discourse. So yes, I think as Dr. Ernst said, it was part of society, a literate, person with these ideas, an intellectual, someone like Hallaj, who has insight into not just his experiences, but into the Quran, right? He'll find a way to put that in the existing forms and genres.
And you mentioned music. One thing that's struck me about Hallaj's poetry is it's eminently singable. The rhymes, the very strong, easy meters, you know, not the super long tawil kind of things. It seems to be very easy to sing. Was he singing his poetry? Were people singing his poetry? Did they play a kind of part in his ritual life or the life of his followers?
I don't know if there's any evidence of that in the early days, but I can tell you that today, if you go on YouTube, you can find dozens of his poems being recited by contemporary singers from Syria, from Jordan, from Egypt, from Morocco. I mean, it's just amazing. And we should remind people that the poems of Hallaj, over 1,000 years old, are pretty clearly understandable to anyone who's educated in Arabic today, which is amazing. We can't do that with European languages. And so I would like to put in a plug for one particular musician who's done an extraordinary job with the poems of Hallaj. He's a Palestinian musician named Issa Boulos, and he has a whole album which is carefully crafted, really unusual, and it puts into music some of the poems which would have been unlikely candidates for that, which are more theoretical and abstract, but he does it so effectively, and I've seen him in person, and he's a great interpreter of that. So, yeah, the musical embodiment of these is certainly quite possible, and I suspect that the more popular of the verses that are quoted very frequently, such as "Ana man ahwa wa man ahwa ana," I am the one whom I desire, the one I desire is I. They could very easily have formed part of the spontaneous musical repertoire of Sufi circles over the centuries.
Fascinating. Well, we've already kind of come to this now, but Professor Zargar, could you tell us a little bit about the legacy and contemporary life of Al-Hallaj's poetry? People are still singing it, obviously. People are making albums of it. Can you tell us a bit more about his legacy and the contemporary life of his poetry?
Well, what I've been interested in and I've been emphasizing is his symbolic legacy, which if you think about the enduring Halajian symbols, you know, the servant lord symbol, that you are a lord when you're a servant. So Ibn Arabi, you know, he quotes Halaj when he wants to say that the basmala, you know, the invocation, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, is to the servant what kun, be, is to God. See the power there. By invoking God in the basmala, you've tapped into that creative power, that creative energy, that he quotes Halaj as the source for that. Second sort of symbolic theme that lives on, I mean, throughout the corpus of Sufi poetry, of course, is the man of God as renegade or scoundrel or outcast or qalandar or rend. And so now, whether Halaj is mentioned or not, and he often is in Persian poetry, you're going to see him in the diwans of Hafez and, as Dr. Ernst said, Rumi, and of course Attar, and on and on, right? He's always there. And so what that means is that, for example, in contemporary Iranian television, when they make a TV series, it's based on the Sheikh of Saman story. It's called Miveh Mamnueh, Forbidden Fruit. It's a really nice kind of contemporary adaptation of it. But you can see the Halajian motif throughout the show. And of course, lastly, to look at fana, annihilation, in terms of love. I mean, let's not forget that the moth and the flame metaphor, so repeated in the Ghazal tradition, comes from Halaj. So that means every time it's invoked, every time you see the moth and the flame, that's Halaj there. That's his influence. So yeah, I think that he's certainly, his legacy is, because he's so early, and because he's so disruptive, it permeates the tradition in this really expansive way.
Wow, fascinating. Professor Ernst, do you have anything to add to that about Halaj's legacy and contemporary life?
Well, I think it can also be said that he has become a symbol of revolt against intolerable authority in a way which doesn't necessarily remain limited to the spirituality of Sufism. And so for quite a few authors writing in Arabic, novelists in Egypt, and poets in Urdu like Faiz, Ahmed Faiz, he is quoted as someone who inspires revolutionary freedom. And this is one of the strongest forms of his popular recognition. So I think it's not inaccurate, by the way. It's a legitimate interpretation. This is another sign of his engagement with the political. And we shouldn't forget that.
Absolutely. Well, wonderful. Thank you so much, both of you, for being with us today to discuss the poetry of Halaj. We hope you listeners will tune in next time for our next podcast series. Thank you again for listening to the Logic of the Birds podcast. Salam.